Hi, everybody. I'm Colleen Younger, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, I see I had a good breakfast, I had a good lunch, I got to run, got a great nap, and Wally just gave me his watch, so I'm in real good shape. I gotta give it back, right? I'm just kidding. Oh, boy. I want to thank you all for inviting me down. You know, I've heard about Mont Eagle for years and have had many good friends that have come down here over the years, and it's my first trip here, and already I feel at home. And I love that part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love that we can go anywhere and walk into any room and be among people that we may have never seen before, but we already know each other. And that's the unique thing that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous in the program of Al-Anon. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since August the 2nd of 1985, and I don't know if that impresses you all, but it certainly impresses me, and I know it impresses my family. I'm looking for that water under here. I'm a member of the Audubon group in Louisville, Kentucky. We meet on Monday nights on Poplar Level Road at the Audubon Park United Methodist Church, and if you're ever in Louisville, Kentucky on a Monday night, I hope you'll come by and visit us. We feel like we got the best group in town, and if you don't feel like your home group's the best one, you better find one that is. But we were talking about my home group today, and I said, you know, we've got a lot of strong women in that group that have been sober for a number of years. I said, we kind of feel like we're the tough ladies group, you know. I'm a little nervous, and I was sharing with Rowan and Sheila and Danis just before I got up here, and I said, you know, my sponsor always tells me that before you come to the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, you just get down on your knees and you take the third step, and once you do that, you know, the rest of it's none of your business. And I always come out a lot better when I let God, get in the driver's seat, and sometimes that's it's hard to do, but I know eventually I'll settle in here, and I had the opportunity to meet Milton a number of years ago, and he didn't remember it, but I did. And I was a member out at the Bardstown group when I was living in Bardstown, Kentucky, and he came up there to speak at one of our anniversaries, I believe, on a Thursday night. And so it was really nice to be able to see him again and to meet new friends, and had a lot of laughs so far. And, you know, we were talking a lot about, you know, Roe and Sheila and what the things that they've been going through recently, and we were all kind of laughing last night, I guess, about, you know, Roe has been forgetting things recently, and we were telling Sheila how to, you know, capitalize on that, you know, and how to get the most out of that, you know, and I'll be darned today if, I didn't run with him, and we got down the road here, and he took me back into this little area called the Assembly, and you know, he had told me before we got back there, we're going to run back here and be about 4 miles or so, and then we're going to be back, you know, and we'll be all right. And we got back in there, and we kept running and running and running. Finally, he looked at me, and he said, Colleen, I don't know where we are. I said, okay. But we made it back. It wasn't the first time in my life I didn't know where I was, I can tell you that. I did know who I was with, though. That was real different. Whew, Lordy. I grew up in downtown Louisville, in the urban inner city down there, and it was a public housing project that I grew up in called Clarksdale. You know, I grew up down there back in the 60s, and, you know, back then, I mean, it was public housing, but it wasn't quite as reduced, I think, to the, what they have today. But, you know, I grew up in a real neighborhood environment in the inner city, and, you know, I'm the child of two alcoholics, and I'm the sister of three alcoholics, and I'm the granddaughter of alcoholics, and I'm the niece of alcoholics, and, you know, the aunt of alcoholics. And I came to you all, and you said, alcoholism runs in families, and I said, well, I must belong here because it galloped in mine, you know, and I mean, it just seems like that every way in the world that you could be related to an alcoholic, that I was, you know, I was right there, and of course, you know, we didn't know it was alcoholism then. We didn't know what to call it. You know, we just knew that every once in a while my mom would send my dad out for a loaf of bread and he might be gone 2 weeks, you know. and that's, you know, we just didn't have an explanation for that kind of stuff. But I grew up down there, and obviously it was a poor environment, and, you know, we didn't have a lot, but we didn't miss anything, because when people live next door to you, don't have anything, you know, you don't have anything to compare it to. And so, you know, it wasn't a bad way to grow up. I grew up in Catholic schools. Well, I went to Catholic grade schools and grew up in the Catholic church, and in many, many, many ways, my life was real good as a kid, and had lots of opportunities, and yet, you know, I had two alcoholic parents. But, you know, it seemed to me like our needs were always met, and really my mom never skipped a beat. I mean, she always made sure everything was taken care of. You know, she made sure her kids were taken care of, and I was the only girl in this family, and I had three brothers, so, you know, right away I was spoiled rotten, and I've stayed that way pretty much most of my life, and but, you know, being in that family as the only girl, and I had these three brothers, and what I remember about myself as a kid was that I felt real different, and I felt like I didn't fit in anywhere. And I always thought that that was because that I was the only girl in his family. You know, I had all those boys, and I couldn't play basketball, you know. And what I know today is that I had the disease of alcoholism long before I ever took a drink, that I had those feelings of alcoholism inside me and long before I ever took any alcohol. But, you know, we were kind of like the Beaver Cleaver family, you know, of Clarksdale Housing Projects. We, every night at 5:30, we sat down at the supper table, and we were all there. And like I said, my mom and dad, we always had our needs met. And you know, I lived down there in the inner city in Louisville, and I lived on the corner of what was back then Hancock and Walnut Street, you know, and it was a rocking neighborhood then, you know, and growing up down in those projects, it was a fast place for a kid to grow up. And, of course, I became the kid in our family that they called, you know, the challenge. And I was the wildcat, you know. And being the only girl, it kind of had a double whammy with it, because I think, you know, most of my life, my family had some real ideals about and hopes about the kind of young lady that they wanted me to grow into, you know. And somewhere along the line, I would always pick up a drink. And when I picked up a drink, all those hopes and all those ideals and all those ambitions went to hell in a handbasket. And I can remember as a young kid being real fascinated by, you know, the alcohol environment. And there was a little joint right down there in the middle of the block on Walnut Street where my mom and dad drank every Friday and Saturday night. And they were beer joint drunks. They weren't high, you know, falutin, sophisticated kind of drunks, you know. And they went every Friday and Saturday night to the 626 bar. And I knew that's where they were every Friday and Saturday night. And, you know, as a young kid, I would sit on the other side of Walnut Street back in that court in those projects, and all my little friends and I would sit over there, and we'd watch all that stuff happen on Walnut Street right there in front of the 626 bar. And, you know, I could look across the street on Friday night, and those guys would be pulling up in those long cars, you know, those long, shiny new cars. And they would open those trunks up, and they'd be pulling out television sets or air conditioners or every kind of small appliance that you could possibly think of. And they were selling them at real cheap cost, you know, real cheap rates. And I knew that none of those guys owned the Western Auto Store, you know. I knew they were stealing that stuff and bringing it in there and unloading it, you know. And yet, you know, those were the kind of people that I thought I wanted to be like when I grew up, because they were the guys that had everything. You know, they wore those shiny new clothes, and they had those shiny new cars, and they always seemed to have those wallets that never ran out of money. And on the inside, I was frightened, and I was confused, you know, and I was just scared to death of everything. And yet, you know, growing up down there in that environment, you know, it wasn't real cool to walk around saying, I'm feeling a little scared today, you know. I mean, I learned to fight very early on in that neighborhood. So, you know, I became a master at building up those walls and building up those facades and putting that shell around me and putting off that, you know, that veneer that made you think that everything was okay on the inside, when really what I was doing was coming apart at the seams. But you know, I would walk into that joint on a Friday or Saturday night, and one whole side of the wall was, you know, those bar stools from wall to wall. And on Friday and Saturday night, there was never any place to sit in the 626 bar. Man, every bar stool was taken, and you know, people were sitting on those bar stools, and they were communicating with each other in a language that I could not speak, in a language that I did not know how to talk. And the other side of the room was, you know, those little booths all the way up and down the wall, and little midget jukeboxes in the middle of every one of those booths. And man, those Patsy Cline tunes were belting out. And my mom and dad were up in the middle of the floor doing the, you know, the rat race, or sometimes in the middle of a barroom brawl. And that's how I grew up, you know, and it was exciting to me. And as a young kid at 8 or 10 years old, I didn't give a damn about the Girl Scouts. You know, I couldn't wait to be inside the 626 bar, you know, on a Friday and Saturday night, and to be old enough to, you know, pull myself up to one of those bar stools and put the next quarter in the jukebox or order the next round of drinks. And it was just be a matter of time before I got there. As a young kid, I went to Catholic grade schools, and I was a pretty good kid in elementary school when I was real young, and learning seemed to come easy for me. And you know, that would all be real short-lived for me, because I became the kid in the classroom that acted out and became the problem kid in the classroom that was always competing with the teacher for the attention of my classmates. And you know, and I had these two older brothers at home, and Charlie was the kind of guy, he'd walk in here tonight, you know, and he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, 18 years, and you know, he's always just kind of been like a little sunbeam walking around. You know, everybody loved him, and he could sing and he could dance, and he was a lot of fun, and he was a good guy. And Joey, my second brother, was a kid in our family that put all of his efforts into athletics. And you know, when he graduated from the eighth grade, they gave him a scholarship to a real good Catholic school there in Louisville, St. Xavier, a very prestigious boys Catholic school there. And he went out there and became a great basketball player and an all-stater there. And then there was me, you know. And I mean, I was hell coming out of the womb, you know, I was trouble. And then I had my younger brother, Patrick, who was so quiet we didn't know he could talk till he was 16, and picked up a guitar and started playing and singing, you know. And that was our family. And I was the kid that was always in a lot of trouble. I was the one that constantly sought out negative attention and negative behavior. And, you know, it wasn't long in that family, everybody was looking at me with that Al-Anon look on their face, you know, like, what is wrong with her? You know, what is wrong with her? And we were laughing earlier today, you know, Eddie and I think about, you know, that whole idea of my whole life, you know, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, was that nobody ever understood me. You know, nobody understood me. And that was my dilemma. But, you know, as a young kid in this family acting out all the time, it kept everything in a lot of chaos. And my mother and I were usually at odds with each other, and I was kind of aligned with my dad. You know, I was my dad's girl, being the only girl, and I was the apple of his eye, and he never made any bones about it, and he let everybody that ever came down the pike know about it right away. And so, you know, that set up a lot of alienation between my mom and I, which would last until we both became members of Alcoholics Anonymous and were able to heal that relationship. But when I got to be about 12 years old, we moved out of the neighborhood. How's this for a concept? The projects were getting bad. So we moved out of the neighborhood, and we moved up in Louisville to a neighborhood called Germantown. And we got up to Germantown, and, you know, Germantown, there was a beer joint on every corner, you know, and yet, you know, I was going into the eighth grade, and I was 12 years old, and as a young kid, I've already told you how filled with fear I was, and I did not have the kind of simple skills, I mean, the very simple skills to be able to walk into a room and stick my hand out and say, I'm Colleen, I'm the new kid here today, can you hang out with me, be my pal. I was so terrified on the inside. I was so filled with self-centered fear. And I got up to St. Therese and going into the eighth grade, and you know, I didn't fit in, and wasn't long into that class that those kids found out that I'd moved there from a rough neighborhood. And as kids often will do, they make you the brunt of their jokes, and they did. And I began to do what I had learned to do down there on the streets of those projects, which was to fight, to defend my honor. And first couple of weeks, you know, I was in school there, and a kid made a crack at me about coming from a bad neighborhood, and I made a crack back at him, you know, and I walloped him. And Sister Amelia, the principal of that school, pulled me into the principal's office and said what I thought was the strangest thing I had ever heard, and that was, Colleen, little girls don't fight. And I thought, well, here's another one that don't understand me, you know, and I'm going to have to take her down to the old neighborhood Friday night and get her broken in so she can understand me and get to know me and relate to me. And that was always my problem. You know, nobody understood me. But, you know, eventually I settled down at school. Shortly after we moved to that neighborhood, I had my first drunk, and I started drinking early. You know, I held off as long as I could, you know. I needed one in the third grade. I just couldn't get a hold of it, you know. So when I was 12 years old, you know, I went back down to that old neighborhood with my older brothers, and it was Christmas Eve, and we went over to that church, that parish that I had grown up in there at St. Boniface, and after midnight mass on Christmas Eve, we stopped back into the old neighborhood, and I was reunited with all the kids I grew up with, and I sat on the steps that night, and my oldest brother Charlie, who had always been my idol and my mentor and my hero, walked in and handed me a bottle of beer. It sounds simple, doesn't it? And harmless. And what happened to me as a 12-year-old was I drank that beer, and I drank as many beers as I could get in me that night, because what happened was the fear inside of me sort of diminished, and all those racing thoughts in my head kind of slowed down, and my eyes got bluer, and all the pimples fell off my face, you know? And for the next 18 years, I was just ready to rock and roll, and that's what I did, you know? And alcohol worked for me for a period of time. Alcohol worked for me, and it would quiet all those fears, and it would allow me to go to those neighborhood teen dances and get out there and dance and fit in, and it would allow me to have those conversations that I had seen those people having sitting on those bar stools at the 626 bar. And it made me feel like I was part of the world. You know, it sort of made me feel like I had stepped inside the circle, because all my life, you were on the other side of a door that I couldn't get through. I couldn't get through. And alcohol opened that door for me. It unlocked that door for me. I had problems from the very beginning. I was not a pretty drunk. Our book says that an alcoholic in her cups is an unlovely creature. And I could not have been more unlovely as a young, drunken teenager. You know, I had that first drunk, and I'm telling you that on Friday night, about every Friday night after that, they pushed me home in a Kroger cart, you know, and I was a mess. I was a mess. And when I got here and I had to think about concepts like pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, they weren't hard for me to remember the situations in my life early on that were a direct result of my drinking alcohol. They weren't hard for me to imagine, because I became an alcoholic from the get-go. It didn't take me long, and I was off and running. I was a blackout drinker as a young teenager, as a young adolescent. I can remember, and I'll share this story with you, not to embarrass myself, but this is who I become when I take a drink. And I don't know what you did in your alcoholism, but I know what I did in mine. And if I took a drink tonight, I'm liable to wet my pants, you know? And if you're next to me, I'm liable to wet yours. And that's how it was, you know? It was a mess. And I can remember being 15 years old, and I was coming home one Friday night, knocked out drunk. Like, I came home every Friday night at 15 years old. And my brother Charlie was coming home from Vietnam, and there were a lot of people at our house, and it had been a real emotional year at our home because my cousin had gotten killed, and Charlie was there, and he was coming home that night and that next day, and all his friends were there. They were making signs and banners and, you know, partying and getting ready to welcome him off the plane. And I came stumbling in that night at 15 years old, and there was a guy at that party that was a real talented artist, and he had taken a white sheet and with colored chalk and colored pencils drawn a beautiful picture about our family and my brother and, you know, Vietnam and a lot of things like that, and very patriotic thing. They were going to carry it as a banner to the airport the next morning, and that fella made the fatal mistake of folding that banner up nicely and neatly and putting it on my bed, and I came in at 15 years old in a drunken, alcoholic stupor. And I went into that bedroom, and I passed out in that bed. And the next morning, what I remember is that there were a number of those people that were at that party standing around me with that Al-Anon look on their face. And I know you know the look that I'm talking about, because it's the look that says, I love you, but what is wrong with you? You know, I love you, but you're disgusting. And what had happened was somewhere in the middle of the night, I had urinated on myself in that alcoholic stupor, and mixed together with that beautiful mural that guy had made with all that colored chalk, and I became one hell of a watercolor abstract, you know. And I was a mess. But what I remember most about that morning, you know, aside from the look on the people's faces, the look on the faces of the people that loved me the most, what I remember was that deep down in my belly, there was something really wrong. And I didn't know what it was, and I didn't name it until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you told me what it was. You told me it was the hideous four horsemen, and it was frustration and terror and bewilderment and despair. And it was in the bottom of my gut as a young kid. And what I could remember was that I sat on those steps just those few short years back, and I took those drinks of alcohol, and alcohol had changed the world for me. And so I'm sure that I got out that day and got something else in me to stop the way that I felt and to calm myself down. And that's how I drank from there on out. You know, I drank because I liked the way it made me feel. I drank for the effect. I ended up graduating from high school a few years later and, you know, had lots of problems in high school. I was a kid that was always kicked out, always having to bring my parents back to get me back in school, a number of suspensions and all that stuff. Very marginal progress in high school and graduated really by the grace of God. And when I was 18 years old, the guy that had been my childhood sweetheart came home from Vietnam, and, you know, he sort of said the now or never deal, and I knew he was a good guy. And so I married him when I was 18 years old. And I want you to know today that if everybody in this room took out a piece of paper and a pencil and wrote down the kinds of qualities that you wanted in the person that you were getting ready to spend the rest of your life with, he'd be on everybody's sheet because he was a good man, and he loved me dearly. And he tried very, very hard for the next 6 years in that marriage to get me to accept his love, to get me to love him back the way that he loved me. And because as a young woman, I was so spiritually bankrupt, I used him and I abused him and I abandoned him 6 years later. And it wouldn't be long into that marriage that he had that Al-Anon look on his face. And I can remember being 24 years old and coming into the kitchen of our home where we had come home from a party late that night. And it was the first time that somebody would mention my drinking to me. And I was 24 years old, and Michael said, "Colleen, you've got to get some help." And he begged me that night, and he pled with me, and he strongly suggested to me that I go to Our Lady of Peace Hospital at that time and get some help. And you know what I suggested to him, don't you? And I left that marriage right away. I divorced him. And by now I was working in the mayor's office for the city of Louisville. And that was a great place for a little kid with an egomaniac with an inferiority complex to end up, you know, right there in the mayor's office. And I really had this idea in my head that because I went to work with the mayor every day, that I couldn't be an alcoholic. You know, and I'd pull down Jefferson Street on my way to City Hall, and I'd get stopped by that red light at Jackson and Jefferson. And there was an old bar right there on the corner, the old Brass Rail Tavern, where my dad used to go and drink. And I'd see some of his old buddies standing out in front of that place in the morning waiting to get in. You know, and sometimes they'd be crowded around a tall brown paper bag. And I would look out of my window, and in all of my alcoholic arrogance, I would say, "By God, if I ever get that bad, I'll stop." And more than anything in the world, more than anything in the world, I did not want to be like my mom and dad. You know? I mean, I wanted something better for myself more than I can tell you. More than I can tell you. And I ended up uniquely like my mom and dad. I got fired from the mayor's office, and I went to work across the street in county government and another big job in county government. And by now, I'm in my mid to late 20s, and I have progressed into the stages of my alcoholism where I have begun to compromise, and I mean compromise, every value, every moral, every belief, everything that was ever important to me, I compromised to take another drink. You know, and what that meant for me at that time was that I couldn't make it to work on time. You know, I don't know about you all, but when I get drunk, you know, I don't show up and I disappear. In fact, I'm the person they put missing persons report out on, you know, and I would go out to lunch and I'd take a drink and I wouldn't go back to work, or I'd go back in a blackout, or, you know, I was working 3 or 4 days a week, and, you know, I was trying to figure out how to get them to mail me my check, you know, I didn't want to go in at all, you know, and what I did during that time was I had you know, an affair with the public official that I worked for. And you know, I was working in the court system, and me and the district judge would, you know, leave the bench together in the afternoon, and we'd go out carousing all night long. And then me and the judge would go back to the bench together in the morning, and the judge would be putting people in jail for the same things we were doing the night before, you know. And I thought, I knew there was something wrong with that picture, but I was on the right side of the bench, you know, and I wasn't about to say anything about it. So, you know, it wasn't long into that job. They always say, you know, politics can get you a job, but it can't keep you one. And I lost that one too, you know. And so by now, you know, I'm 28 years old and I am unemployable. I cannot hold a job. I mean, my alcoholism has progressed to the point that I cannot hold a job. And, you know, at that time I went to work in a bar. They always told me if you drank long enough, you go to work in a bar, you'd be a painter, and I couldn't paint, you know, so I had to take the bar job, and I went to work in the bar. And there was a little bar down there in downtown Louisville, and, you know, it was a place where a lot of the professional people from downtown stopped in and drank on the way home. And you know, there was a guy that used to come in that bar, and you know how alcoholics are. We have relationships in dog years, you know, and we met and we dated for 2 weeks, and it seemed like 7 years. So we moved in together right away. And, you know, I have this unique way of convincing myself that it's Mr. Right, and what it always is, Mr. Right Now, you know, So we moved in together right away, and you know, I don't know, there is a special brand of self-delusion that comes with this disease. I mean, I have the kind of self-delusion that I can make myself believe anything if I want to believe it bad enough. You know, and at that time during my life, but the, you know, the lie was that he was the man. He was Mr. Right, you know. And when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to get to that inventory part, you know, that fourth step and those relationships and all that. I had to look at that relationship. And what I know was that he wasn't, you know, Mr. Right. He was a stockbroker. He wore nicely tailored three-piece suits. He drove a long, shiny new Cadillac, and he had a wallet that never ran out of money, you know, and I wanted what he had, and I went to any length to get it, and I did, you know, and that relationship lasted for 5 years, and we traveled from coast to coast and all over the place and spent a fortune of money because this guy drank just like me. And I mean, we were put out of the best places in, you know, all over the map, and we were put out of the worst places all over the map because it just didn't matter, you know. Whenever we took a drink, what would follow was some, you know, insanely bizarre behavior, and we probably would end up in a fight, and people would ask us to leave, you know. And 5 years later, when I left that relationship, my oldest brother Charlie was getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I had really progressed into some real depths with my disease, and I was using a lot of other things and having a lot of physical problems. And I can remember during those times that, you know, I would have seizures. And I can remember coming out of a seizure off of the bathroom floor in my mother's home and my youngest brother and my mom standing over me with tears in their eyes, you know, and begging me to go get some help, to let them take me to the hospital. But you know what I needed that day more than a hospital was another drink. And I would get up off of the floor and I would go get in my car and I would go get it. And, you know, I just never knew how I affected the people that loved me the most. I never knew how much I affected the people that loved me the most. I left that relationship and I went and stayed with my friend who was, you know, working and had a job, and, you know, somebody had to, I didn't. So I moved in there and she paid all the bills and took care of me and, you know, did all the things because I could not suit up and show up for life. You know, the very best I could do would be, you know, to get up to the corner that became my daily watering hole that day and get something else in me. And during this time, my father had been sent home from the hospital to die with his alcoholism. And my daddy was 58 years old when he died from his alcoholism. And he had been a big, strong man all of his life. And, you know, and as I already told you, I had a real special relationship with my dad, and I loved him more than anything in the world. And if there was ever a person in my life that I experienced unconditional love from before Alcoholics Anonymous, it was my dad. And I can remember being in that apartment one Thursday night, and the telephone rang, and I answered the phone, and it was my daddy, and he said, "Colleen, I'd like to see your smiling face." And I said, "I'm on my way, Daddy." And I walked out that apartment, and I got into the car, And I stopped right up there at that corner, at that little place, that little pub that I'd been going to every day. And I took a drink just to calm me down so I could go over there and be with my dad. And 4 days later on Monday morning, I came out of a blackout. And I was back in that apartment and I answered that phone again. It was my mother on the other end telling me my daddy had died. And I can't tell you where I was for those 4 days because I don't know where I was. And you know, sometimes I think blackouts are mercy. Sometimes think blackouts are God's way of being merciful to us. But you know, I hated myself for that. I hated myself for that. You know, and I would look in the mirror and I would think, how have you become what you are? How have you become? You know, and I just hated being in my own skin, but I didn't know the way out yet. And during that time I came, it was 1982, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard a guy from New Albany, Indiana talk, and he was a blind man named Jim Walk, you know. And man, he had one story about recovery and about alcoholism. And I sat on the front row that night next to my older brother, and I laughed and I cried, and I went back to the bar stool at Jim Gravett's Tavern immediately after that meeting because I still had this idea in my head that I am different than you. I am different than you. And as long as I feel like I am different than you, I stay drunk. I cannot recover. I cannot recover until I find that identification. That's the wonderful thing. That's the wonderful element of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that element of identification, where I come into the rooms and I get to hear that I am not so different anymore. Because I was holed up inside of myself for years. I thought I was the only one that lived and did the things that I lived and did. You know, and I came to you all and you all began to share yourselves with me, and I found out that I wasn't so different after all. That's the process of recovery for me. That's where it started for me. That maybe if somebody like me could get this thing, or maybe if somebody like you could get this thing, maybe I could too. I came in and out of AA for 3 years. I stayed, you know, sober 14 days during those 3 years. And I thought, man, 2 weeks is a long time to go without a drink, and I need one. And I went and got one right away. And, you know, I want you to know that during those, from 1982 to 1985, I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't get a home group. And I sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would listen to people just like me, and I would pick you apart. And I would sit there, back there in the back, and I'd take your inventory, and I'd find every way in the world to be different than you. And it kept me drunk over and over and over again. I ended up in a shack over on Goss Avenue in Germantown, and I was 28 years old, and I was a raging alcoholic and drug addict. And I had some medical tests done. And I called and got the results, and I was, you know, the rabbit had died, you know, and I was unemployed. I was homeless. I didn't have a place to live. And now I was pregnant. And you know what? I went to my mother and I went to that family that had always been there for me. And I told my mom what my situation was. And she called that sober brother, Charlie. And he came to me and he was 6 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he stuck his hand out and he said, Colleen, please let me help you. Please. And I'd like to tell you that I jumped on the bandwagon, but I didn't. And I'm going to tell you, my brother went on a mission. And he damn near 12 stomped me into Alcoholics Anonymous before I got sober. And thank God that the God of my understanding is a merciful God. And he picked my brother up during that time and he transferred him out of town with his job and moved him to Lexington, Kentucky. And when Charlie moved out of town to Lexington, Kentucky, there was a seat for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was 30 years old when I got sober in 1985, and I came to. That baby had been born in 1984, and I had gotten a job back in city government, and you know, trying to do the right thing, but going out still with the same people, doing the same things, not being able to take care of that baby the way that he needed to be taken care of. And thank God that my family stepped up to the plate. And finally, you know, my brother coaching my mother from Lexington got her to Al-Anon, and coaching my best friend got her to Al-Anon, and they stopped enabling me. And they literally said, Colleen, we're not going to help you kill yourself anymore. And they stopped doing all the things to bail me out, you know. And I can remember during those times I would come home from work, and I had gotten a job back in City Hall, and I would come in, and every night about 7:30, Mom and my friend Barb would jump up, and I would say every night like a big fish, you know, "Where are y'all going?" And they'd say, "We're going to our Al-Anon meeting." Man, I wanted to poke their eyeballs out. I mean, I wanted to get them, you know, because I just knew they were in there talking about me. They were telling all my secrets, you know, and I was mad at them. And finally, on August the 2nd of 1985, I came to in that bedroom that I had come to in for many, 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 many years, you know. And in many ways, all of the same things were the same that morning, but there was one unique difference. And that was that I came to, and those hideous four horsemen were still in my belly. But for the first time in my life, as a young woman, I recognized myself as an alcoholic. I accepted myself as an alcoholic. And I said that short alcoholic prayer of "God help me." And from there, all sorts of remarkable things followed. You know, and I began that process of surrender. And that night, I came out and went to the Token Club to a meeting, a Saturday night meeting up at the Token Club. And how is this for the grace of God? I walked into the meeting at the Token Club with a sincere desire to be sober, with my mother on one arm and my best friend on the other arm. They finally got in the right room too, you know. How is that for the grace of God? To be able to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous with your mother and your best friend of 20 years on either side of you. That is grace that I can't even hardly imagine gifts so huge. And I want you to know that I know this program is based on attraction. This thing is about example. It's not about promotion or trying to point your finger in somebody's face to get the point across. This is about somebody showing up quietly and sober and sanely in front of me and demonstrating in front of me what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous does so well. And I know that I never know who my teachers are going to be. The person that attracted me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was somebody that I didn't think had anything to give me. What could I learn from my baby brother? 9 years younger than me, 20 years old, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. What could he give me? But Patrick suited up and showed up as a sober member, and he came around and he was just real quiet, you know, just real quiet and real compassionate. And I saw something in him that I wanted for myself. And I came to AA on August the 2nd of 95, and I never left again after that. And I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous right away. And I began to do the things that they asked me to do. In fact, they didn't ask me to do them. They said, if you want to stay sober, you will. You know, we hear a lot of talk in AA today about suggestions. I don't know what suggestions are. I had to learn to take directions. I was so sick, you know, and we were talking about this earlier today. I am grateful that I got that sick, because it made me much more teachable. When I got here, I was way too sick to argue anymore. The fight was over for me. And I did things I would never have done, but I did them because they told me if I would, I would stay sober. And I got a home group right away, and I got a sponsor. And my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous was the girl that used to be my bartender at the Outlook Inn in Louisville. I mean, I thought she already knows the story. I might as well pick her. You know, and a couple of weeks before my token birthday, I called her up and I said, "Now you're going to be at my meeting to give me my token, right?" And she said, "Colleen, I got drunk." I was devastated. I couldn't believe it. That's why they say things like stick with the winners. Stick with the winners. And then at a year sober, I got to be sponsored by the woman that still sponsors me today that has shown me more about unconditional love than anybody I have ever known in my whole life. She has literally opened the channels for me and shown me the way to a God of my understanding. And I can't be more grateful for my sponsor. I can't be more grateful. When I was 5 years sober, my sponsor was having a kidney transplant because she is a very severe diabetic. And I can remember leaving my home group on a Saturday night, 5 years sober. And I went to the hospital. And Sonny had had her kidney transplanted that day. And I sat beside her hospital bed. And I read to her from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a spiritual experience for me. It was the first time in my life that I realized that I was useful. It was the first time in my life I realized that God had made me useful. That I was able to finally give something back to the people who had saved my life and made a quality of life for me that was far above anything I had ever known in my life. I've been very active in AA, and you know, I try to stay active, and I work with a lot of other women, and I sponsor a number of women. And you know, I can sponsor women because I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has taught me how to sponsor other people. And that's how it's handed down, you know. And we go through the steps once a year. And, you know, I'll tell you a story that happened a couple of years ago. And I had a step group in my home, and there were 18 women in the step group. And five of these women were coming out every Tuesday night from the penitentiary to my house to go through the steps. And they were still locked up in the penitentiary. And they let them come through, come out for the evening to the step group. And during the course of that process of going through those steps, all five of those women got to go back out into the free world. And all five of them are still sober today, as sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember the night that we took the third step in that meeting, and there were 18 of us sitting around in that living room that night. And we were taking the third step, and we were, after we took the third step together, each person went around the room and we shared one word that would describe the God of our understanding. You only got one word to do it in. And that night, after everybody left and I was going to bed, my heart was filled, because every word that was shared by every woman in that room was something I believed. And that's a far cry from the day I hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I didn't believe that God would want anything to do with somebody like me. You see, I always had it backwards. I thought you had to get good enough to go to God. And I could never get good enough. And what you all have taught me is that God enters where I am, right at the wound where I am. You know, and that's what grace is all about. The more sick I am, you'll be glad to hear this, Eddie, the more sick you are, the more he loves you. I've had some great experiences, and a couple that stand out over the last several years in my life are one about my son who is now 16 years old and has just started experimenting in his own disease. But he's a real good athlete. He's an outstanding basketball player. And a few years ago, I was living out in Bardstown, and Adam came home. He was 12 then, and he said, "Mom, I made the Nelson County AAU basketball team." And, you know, I was just real excited for him about that. And he had been going to Alateen for a number of years then. And I didn't even know what all that stuff was, you know, but he said, "Mom, I just want to be there." And so I want you to know that, you know, we suited up and showed up, and in my finite human mind, we were walking into the Nelson County High School gymnasium, and I was saying, "Now, Adam, don't get your hopes up. These kids been playing together for a few years. You're the new kid on the block. You got to pay your dues. Just sit over there and be quiet. Probably not going to start. Might not get to play." Those are the things that I'm telling my child walking in there in my finite human mind. And we got inside, and lo and behold, the team we were playing was Lexington Catholic, and Rick Pitino's son was coaching the Lexington Catholic team. So we were all immediately intimidated, thinking we were going to lose the first game of the tournament, and sure enough, the game started, and just like I said, Adam didn't get to start. Didn't get to play the whole game. And finally, God answered my prayers. There was 2 minutes to go, and the kid that started in front of him fouled out. And Adam got to go into the ball game. 2 minutes to go in the ball game, down by 8 points. We start catching up, made some points, get all the way down to 18 seconds on the clock. You know, sometimes God just takes you right on down to the wire, you know. Kind of like the finish line of the Kentucky Derby, you know, it's like a photo. And it was 18 seconds left on the clock, and we were still down by 1 point. Finds a little point guard, and he drove in for a layup, and he missed the layup, but he got fouled. And he went to the free throw line, and he made both those damn free throws. And they won the game, and they carried him off the floor. He was the hero of the game. And I always tell that story because it's the best illustration I can give you of my will against God's. That's my plan against what God has in store for me. And I'm going to tell you, I stood up there in those bleachers that day, 11 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my heart sung, and tears rolled down my face when he made those free throws, and he became a hero that day. And I was so grateful to be present in that moment. And I know the only reason that I was present in that moment was because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I am the one that disappears. I'm the one my mother puts missing person reports out on. But I was there today. I was there today, that day. And you know, I've never forgotten that. You know, and those are the special times in my sobriety that let me know I am overpaid. It's not the big deals in life, you know. It's the small, quiet moments of just being able to be where I'm supposed to be, when I'm supposed to be there, you know. Being able to suit up and show up for life and be the kind of mom that I always wanted to be, you know. When I was 10 years sober, I had some pretty painful things happened in my life, and I was still living in Bardstown at that time, and I had come into Louisville to visit my mom, and it was Christmas week, and I went to her place, and she had her little place all decorated with the Christmas music on and all that, and I can remember standing there in the living room, and she said, "Come here, Colleen, I want to show you something." And my mother and I had been adversaries and had been at each other's throats all of our lives. And she pulled me into that living room, and she had this big doll that was sitting on the couch. And she pulled me over there, and she went and got that doll. And I said, "Oh, Mom, you've gotten that doll for Catherine." Catherine was my brother's little girl, who was 2 years old at the time. I said, "You bought that doll for Catherine for Christmas." And my mother went over there and got that doll, and she brought it over to me. And she said, "No, I got that doll for my little girl." And she put that doll around me and put her arms around me, and we stood in the middle of that living room. And I want you to know that 40 years of alienation and hostility and resentment diminished in that moment of grace that Alcoholics Anonymous gave us. We stood there in that living room, embraced, both of us, 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful. I can't do enough to give back to the program that has not only given me my life, but has given every one of my brothers and my mother their life back. Every one of them. I had a brother that relapsed recently after 12 years. And I want you to know he was the only one in our family that didn't get a home group, didn't get a sponsor, and did it his way. And 12 years dry, he chose to use again. And just a couple of weeks ago, my youngest brother and I had to go call on him and take him to the University of Louisville Psychiatric Unit and take out a mental inquest warrant on him. But I want you to know I could do it because I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you have taught me how to do the next right thing. You have taught me how to do that. He's sober today some 14 or 15 days. And he's in treatment, and he's probably more grateful than I have ever seen him. You know, and you know, I know my son's going to need you, and I know you'll be there for him. And I'm not confused to think that I can be the one to carry him the message or to help him. You know, I went through that with my whole family. And the more my brother tried to push AA on me, the more I hated him. You know, and if you're here tonight and you got a family member that needs help, get the hell out of the way and let somebody else help them. You know, because we are just too close to him, just way too close. About a year and a half ago, and I'm going to close with this story, about a year and a half ago, I stood on the altar at St. Agnes Church in Louisville, and I held a pudgy, blue-eyed, cotton-top baby boy named Michael. And he was the baby of my baby brother, Patrick. And Michael was getting baptized that day, and I was the godmother. I was the godmother. Me. For somebody that came from my other brothers asking their children not to look at me and stay away from me and don't go around her because they never knew what I was going to do or what I might expose them to. To holding that baby in my arms up there on that altar as the godmother and spiritual guide for that baby. How do you get there from where I came from? You get there by getting a home group, getting a sponsor, integrating the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in your daily life, contacting a relationship with the God of my understanding every day, every day. The most important and most primary relationship in my life is the relationship that you gave me with the God of my understanding, who is so powerful and so incredible that words that I give you can't even describe. They always fall short, you know. And that's how I got there, to that altar that day. And with experiences like that and the quality of life that you all have given me, I know that I'm overpaid. That every day that I'm on the other side of the dirt breathing air in contact with a newcomer or with my sponsor, I am overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't ever get even with that debt. I love you all. I love you all for what you have made me. I love you all for loving me when I couldn't love myself, for showing me the way, for taking me out of blackouts and bar rooms and back seats and hotel rooms and bringing me into your hearts and loving me until I could love myself. I'm grateful for that. I thank you all for having me, and I hope that we have a great weekend, and my part's over now, and I can relax and have some fun. And God bless you all, and I hope we always come back. Thanks.